मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमिन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासंगतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा।
Shivoham, Shivoham. अहम् भोजनम् नैव भोज्यम् न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् अहम् निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव
मुक्तिर्न मे चिदानन्द रूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्द रूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्द रूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्द रूपा शिवोऽहं 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 शिवोऽहं
Welcome to the final class in this sequence of the Splendid Journey. It is our final class for August, but it's not the end of our Shiva Sutras study, simply the end of part one. And I just want to say that we will be announcing the dates of the new class, but I'll tell you now, it's going to be in November, probably starting in the second week of November, and that we'll be doing a little bit of an overview, but essentially moving deeply into book three and then also working with some of the sutras that we didn't get to work with in book one. You know, my favorite method of studying texts like the Shiva Sutras is to go sutra by sutra rather than doing an overview, which, you know, as a kind of a survey of the book. And the reason I like to do it like this, even though it can be kind of frustrating because we often end up not actually finishing the study in the short time that a course like this allows. But the thing that is so beautiful about it, at least for me, is that there's so much juice in sutra study when we contemplate one sutra at a time and really give ourselves the time to look at not only the Sanskrit, which is very important, not only the meaning of the sutra, but to read through the commentaries, to hold the sutra in awareness, and to actually let yourself mine your own consciousness for the insights that the sutra starts to give you when you let yourself dwell on it for a while. And you know, one of the things about this text, about the Shiva Sutras especially, is that you can really get a lot out of it, out of the sutras, by contemplating one or two. In other words, you don't have to read the whole thing. I mean, in one, not that reading the whole thing is not incredibly powerful, and I'm hoping that we will get to do that more or less by the time we're complete with this process. But, for instance, the first three sutras, the first two sutras in every one of the books, Chaitanyam Atma and Jnanam Bandha in book one, Chittam Mantraha and Prayatnaha Sadakaha in book two, and Atma Chittam and Jnanam Bandha, which are the opening two sutras of book three, they actually do contain in and of themselves the entire philosophy of Kashmir Shaivism from the point of view of absolute awareness, that is, full immersion in what's called Shiva consciousness, from the point of view of Shakti's awareness, that is, from the point of view of one who is fully immersed in the subtle creative energy of Shakti, and in book three, from the point of view of the individual. In each of the sutras, in each of the books, the teachings that flow in the earlier books are recapitulated in the later books in ways that allow us to connect to them from wherever we happen to be at a given time. And the thing that I have really loved about studying Kashmir Shaivism with you guys is that, I mean, first of all, it's always revelatory for me. Every time I read one of these texts, I see it in a fresh way. It goes in a deeper way. But also, I get to see how these teachings go in to you, how they get assimilated in you. And because I've known so many of you over the years, I've worked with so many of you in these teleclasses and in many cases in person or on the phone, I've seen how your consciousness changes. I've seen, especially in this class, I've watched some of you really making profound shifts, not only in the way you're holding your life, not only in the way you're holding yourself, but also in your practice. There, you know, if some of you may have read, and I hope you all do, the note that Phyllis sent into the listserv this morning. She posted it on the listserv about how she's always been what we would call a Shakta Upaya meditator, that is, someone who meditates most happily on pulsation, on mantra, on the powers within language. And there's good reason for that. If you study with me, that's generally speaking how you're going to study, because I am very much a Shakta Upaya practitioner. It's not the only way I practice, but it's kind of where I, you know, where my deep love for the teachings comes out. Partly, I think, because I love language and I love the energy in language. I love the energy that emerges from holding these teachings. But anyway, Phyllis wrote that in the last few weeks of this course, she has begun to find it not only easy, but very alluring to meditate on awareness itself, on awareness of awareness. And, you know, this is actually one of the, you know, it's a symptom, I would say, of the way these teachings work in you, so that they kind of cook you at a, you know, they cook you at the level you're at a given time, and then they take you to a subtler level, and they do this on their own if we allow it. So one of the things about the way we work with sutras and the transmission that comes through in these sutras is that it is, as we've said several times, really, really helpful to repeat the words of the sutra to yourself. That definitely the Sanskrit, because there's enormous Shakti in the Sanskrit, and it is the original language. And, you know, for those of you who have what one Indian friend of mine called a lazy American tongue, certain people who are native speakers in languages like French and Italian have more flexible tongues for Sanskrit. People in the Anglo world, Americans, UK citizens, UK natives, and Australians in particular, seem to have a harder time getting our tongues around the syllables. But even if we're pronouncing the words, pronouncing the letters without complete capacity, nonetheless, if we're pronouncing them with a real intent to learn, to assimilate them, they go in, and they go in not only into the mind, they go in to the prana, into the particles of your energy body, your pranamaya kosha, you know, that aspect of the subtle body that interpenetrates the physical body as the life energy that runs through your nadis. You know, when we talk about embodying a teaching or bringing a teaching, you know, deeply assimilating a teaching, it's very helpful to consider how you can assimilate it through the pranamaya kosha, which might mean that you take the sutras into a walk, that you say it to yourself while you're walking or while you're dancing. In other words, while you're moving your body, or you know, as we often do, you breathe with the syllables. And you can do this very effectively both with the Sanskrit and also with the English. And as we do that, the wisdom and the Shakti in the sutras will interpenetrate all of your koshas, all of the bodies, which many of you know, especially if you've studied yoga for a while, you know, these different layers of ourselves nest within each other like Russian dolls. And the wisdom of non-dual teachings actually needs to go through all the layers. It needs to fill all the layers, and we are going to be talking about that in one of the other sutras that we discussed today. And, you know, one other thing for some of us, especially those of us with very active minds, falling asleep during a lecture, as several of you have shared happens to you in these sessions, falling asleep during a lecture is not necessarily mean that you're not hearing the teachings, and it's not just because I have a hypnotic voice, which of course I know I do. It is often the intelligence of your own Shakti that's pulling you under, that's pulling you into the causal layer of yourself, the causal body being the subtlest part of your individual self. Why is this true? It's because inside the causal body are layered the samskaras, the limiting thought forms that we really can't see. You know, they're so deeply hidden inside that layer of ourselves that we normally only access in deep sleep, that we're not aware of how much these samskaras are affecting us. They, you know, they're literally the thought forms, the conditioned understandings and traumas that are lodged inside the causal body, which include all, you know, the collective traumas that so many of us hold, the ancestral traumas that so many of us hold. That we may not be consciously aware that we have them or that we feel them, but the body knows. And so how do we clear these samskaras? We clear them, of course, in meditation. We also clear them when we're sitting in the presence of a transmission, which is the essence of what goes on here. And when you let yourself just go out or go into a kind of a dream state. One of my friends tells a story about how he used to, for years, go into a kind of a blackout state during meditation, and he felt very bad about it, because in many meditation traditions, they'll tell you that the point is to stay alert in meditation. And so one day he drank a cup of coffee, and he was sitting open, you know, highly alert during his meditation, and then suddenly he heard the voice of his guru coming up from inside saying, "What are you doing awake? Don't you realize that I push you into the sleep state during meditation so that the Shakti can clean out your samskaras more easily? Because if you stayed awake, you would probably resist the process." So I actually love that story, and it's true, it's real. The experience of hearing these teachings, the experience of reading over the sutras, the experience of contemplating them, is going to reprogram the source code that makes you who you are. And I mean that in a good way, because the source code that I'm talking about is the source code of limitation. So let yourself go into whatever state arises during these calls. But if you are going out, I really recommend that you listen to a second time to the class so that your intellect and your waking intellect can assimilate it on an intellectual level. So in this transformative process, which has been very intense for some of you and not quite so intense for others, but which is happening for everybody who's present with us, this transformative process that is naturally opening through the sutras is a manifest form of the Guru Shakti, which is the topic, one of the topics we're going to discuss today, because the Shiva Sutras, this text, is a Guru. So in this session, we're going to look at Sutra 6, the Sutra on the Guru, as well as Sutras 8 and 9. So let's begin our practice, and you can find a posture that feels comfortable, upright, steady. One of the Shiva Sutras says, "A yogi in a steady posture easily becomes immersed in the heart." And as we've said in earlier classes, what we mean by the heart is the heart of consciousness, the great heart, where Shiva Shakti, living union, holding the entire universe, all universes, gross and subtle within them. So our steady posture is the first prerequisite for entering the heart. And you can feel that with your magic fingers. I love to do this practice like this, with this thought that I'm making light arise from my fingers. With your magic fingers, kindle a candle. Feel the presence of this circle that we're sitting in, the presence of all of us, all around the world. And then place your candle, your tea light, or your great big pillar candle, or whatever candle, or your delicate little taper candle in the middle of the circle. And just for a moment, let's acknowledge the presence of the flames that each one of us deeply are. And we'll chant three times. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave. Satchitananda Murtaye. Nishprapanchaya Shantaya. Niralambaya Tejase. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. And we'll chant the mantras to the great Guru, Dakshinamurti Stotram. Actually, I'd like to chant the goddess mantras first, if that's okay. I'm getting this kind of signal to chant the goddess mantras. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sarike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sarike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sarike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. And finally, the Dakshinamurti Shloka. Gurave Sarvalokanam Bisaje Bhavaroginam Nidhaye Sarvavidyanam Dakshinamurtaye Namaha. Gurave Sarvalokanam Bisaje Bhavaroginam Nidhaye Sarvavidyanam Dakshinamurtaye Namaha. So thank you for bearing with me as we change the order and even the content of the mantras. And allow yourself once again to refresh your posture. We're going to meditate on a practice for divinizing the body that's very much a part of the Shakta aspect of the Shaiva Tantra. This is a practice for opening up to the reality of what your body is really made of. As you inhale with the feeling that you're breathing in a golden white light from your crown, and just feel that light begins to infuse the top of your head, to flow through the inner part of the head, including the brain, the sinuses. Light fills up the cavern within your mouth. It fills your face. it flows through the passages of the inner ear and the middle ear. It flows through the bones of the skull. And as you inhale and exhale, allow the flow of the breath to move down through your neck, golden white light filling your throat, the bones and ligaments of your neck. Inhaling and exhaling as the light flows through your shoulders and upper back, as it moves through the collarbone, through the bones and cartilage of the breastbone, through the organs in your upper torso, the trachea, the esophagus, the lungs, the heart. As it moves through your breasts and flows through your skin, filling your rib cage, beginning to flow through the vertebra of your spine, infusing the entire lower back, the muscles as well as the bones, with golden white light, and flowing down through the viscera. You inhale and exhale and begin to sense this light energy inside your liver, your stomach, your spleen, your kidneys. Even if you can't differentiate between these organs, feel that the energy of light is flowing all the way through your inner body, filling up, opening, healing the organs of your upper abdomen, flowing into your small intestine, clearing your small intestine of any of the residue of disease or bad diet, flowing into your colon, flowing through your generative organs, your sexual organs, the energy flowing into your pelvis, your hips and buttocks, and beginning to flow down your legs, the bones of your thighs, the muscles, the skin, the joints, both in your hips and your knees. And let the light, with each inhalation and each exhalation, let the light flow down your legs into the small bones of your ankles and your feet and your toes. And now with every inhalation, imagine that light flows into the crown and simply flows through your body, meeting the light that has already been installed there. And with the exhalation, it flows gently back up. See if you can just allow the breath to flow through your body as particles of light. See if you can let this happen effortlessly, not necessarily making a strong effort to visualize anything. Rather, knowing that light is your essence, that light is the heart of the prana shakti that flows through the breath. That light is what you are. As you flow out of formal meditation and into listening meditation, just take a moment to be aware of your inner state. Always a good idea at the end of meditation. And I'm going to ask you to check into your inner state periodically over the course of the next almost 2 hours. So today we'll be looking at three sutras, Sutra 6, Sutra 8, and Sutra 9. Sutra 6 is the Guru Sutra, Guru Rupayaha, which paya means method or means, and guru literally means dark to light, which we usually translate as guru is that which leads us from darkness to light. Sutra 8, Shariram Havihi. Sharira is the body. We'll discuss the esoteric meaning of this word when we get to it. Havihi means offering. It's based on a Sanskrit word for ritual offering. And Shariram Havihi means the body is the offering. And Sutra 9, Jnanam Anam, knowledge is food. Very, very mysterious sounding sutra that actually describes pretty much what happens as we meditate with this knowledge, with this understanding. So, Guru Rupayaha, Guru is the means. So, to understand this, it's really important that we have the tantric understanding of guru. The word guru, like many Sanskrit words, has many, well, not many, but several meanings, several significant meanings. For instance, in Vedic astrology, guru is the name of the planet Jupiter, and it's called Jupiter, it's called guru because Jupiter is supposedly the planet of blessing, and it's also the biggest, the heaviest. So one of the meanings of the word guru is heavy. And if you've ever had a guru in a strong physical form, or let's say if you've ever had a traditional guru from one of the Eastern guru lineages, you know that heavy is not a bad word to describe human beings who act as gurus. And I mean that in a good way. But in traditional India, a guru is often considered to be anyone who is qualified to dispel your ignorance in any way, in any subject. So, for example, your high school teacher can be addressed as Guruji and often is because he or she is dispelling your ignorance of math, of language, of science. If you're studying one of the sacred sciences like Indian music or dance or Ayurveda or astrology, your teacher will be respectfully addressed as Guruji, precisely because they're initiating you and opening you to a very profound method of knowledge. So we could say that anyone who teaches you is, in a sense, a guru, which is, of course, the way we often use this word in the West. But in the non-dual traditions, when they talk about guru, they aren't just speaking about the human teacher. And even the human teacher who is a master of enlightenment, even a human teacher who is what in the tradition is called the Sadguru or the true guru, who's somebody that is themselves enlightened and who is able to pass on or transmit enlightened states to you. The guru in Tantra is not the human teacher. The guru is the Shakti. The guru is the Anugrahika Shakti, the grace-bestowing power that is inherent in consciousness, that is inherent in the great awareness that is the source of everything. And in Sanskrit, there's a sutra that actually comes from the commentary on the recognition sutras that we studied in 2018. It goes, Guru Parameshwari Anugrahika Shaktihi. Guru is the grace-bestowing power of God. And interestingly enough, the ending of Parameshwara is the feminine ending. So this reinforces the idea that the Guru is Shakti, literally the liberating Shakti, but the transpersonal, transformational power of grace, which can manifest through any vehicle. Someone once came to see my guru and said, you know, last year I was in the desert at Joshua Tree in California, and I was staring at the sun, which I personally wouldn't think was a good idea, but which she had been drawn to do. And she said this ray of energy came into my body through my eyes, filled my body, and ever since then, I've been having all these experiences of active kundalini. And how can that happen? And my guru said, because the force of grace came to you through the sun. And, you know, this is, it really helps explain something that many of you may have experienced, which is that, you know, that awakening force can come to you through nature, often comes through the natural world, can come through another person. And the person that it comes through, although in many cases that person is someone who is very worthy of respect, who is more or less enlightened, who has a lot to teach you, nonetheless, the force of grace that awakens and guides you and that little by little or all of a sudden transforms your life is independent of any individual. In fact, one of the commentators first quotes Abhinavagupta, the great Shaiva sage, as saying that the power that moves through the guru's word, which I take to mean the guru's teachings and the guru's mantra, is greater than the guru themselves, which is a pretty far out statement if you think about it. You know, it actually means that the guru is the Shakti in the mantra and in the teachings. So that force of grace obviously moves very strongly through the Shiva Sutras, which have been empowered both by the one who spoke them, who is Shiva himself, according to tradition, also to the lineage of Shaiva masters, which goes back to the 7th century and, you know, very much moves through this particular form. And also it's empowered by several modern guru lineages, including my own guru lineage. So the guru shakti is baked into these sutras, and it's also baked into the sangham, which is not something that we always realize, although I think you guys do. I think you know what a gift of awakening and what a gift of sustenance for your practice this particular shakti vortex that we call the sangham really is. So what happens when the transformative force of the anugrahika shakti, the guru force in the universe begins to enter us and affect us, it manifests in many different ways, and all of you have been reporting versions of this. Sometimes it manifests as love, and there's a very, very deep feeling of loving yourself, loving other people, loving your teacher, or just loving. At times it shows us the barriers, the blocks that seem to cut us off from love, or which, you know, it shows us the structures of conditioning that we may have been carrying since childhood that have made it hard for us to feel free and loving in the world. Sometimes it manifests in the midst of terrible challenges as the kind of light of truth that can show us how to turn the challenge into a path to transformation. And the guru principle operates on a kind of a macro level as the force that moves through cultures, the force that moves through societies, that actually evolves consciousness through the collective. Sometimes that evolutionary force, which is raising consciousness in some parts of the collective, is also creating, you know, fear and loathing in other parts of the collective, which is why it sometimes feels as though collectively we are moving, you know, one step forward, two steps back sometimes. But the thing about the guru force is that it never stops. So even when it feels like there have been huge setbacks in our personal sadhana or in our collective sadhana, the guru force is always manifesting as an internal imperative, a push that demands that is, that not just demands, but that moves us towards greater openness, greater resonance with the divine will, with truth, and with the expansion of our own potential. So at least for people on the path of the Shaiva Tantrikas, the intention of the Guru Force is that we experience our absolute identity with divine consciousness, with God. Not only our own identity, but the identity of everything and everyone in this world. And once it's grabbed hold of us, it doesn't let go. My guru used to say, the guru is like the mouth of a crocodile. You know, once a crocodile has grabbed you, you can't shake it off. It's the same with the guru's grace. Once it grabs you, it doesn't let you go. And that force of the guru is not confined to the person with whom you may or may not have a personal relationship with. It's flowing through our relationships, but it's independent of them. So, as you know, once the Guru Force starts to operate, it's working through all the events and circumstances of our life, and it's working through them so as to both show us the love that is our essence, and also to show us the barriers that keep us from seeing it. So as we discuss these sutras, we're going to consider them in the light of this deeper movement of the Guru as the liberating force within consciousness. One of my friends, who's a scholar of Kabbalah, quotes one of the great Kabbalistic sages who had some very similar ideas to the Shakta Tantrikas. He said that true transformation involves rewriting the source code. And, you know, source code is a computer term. It's, you know, you have to re-enter the source, which for us is on an individual level inside the causal body, the body that we mentioned that we enter in deep sleep, which also happens to be the part of ourselves that is deeply shrouded in Maya, in that separative function that keeps us cut off from the self. So the words, the Shakti, the realizations have to flow into the source, bringing grace in the form of a mantra or the form of these teachings into your programming, that is, into the conditioning that has been locked into your causal body. And then you have to sort of sit tight, whether through the course of a meditation or through the course of months and years, and to be really honest, to experience this total transformation for all but a very few people. Actually, it actually takes place over years. And when we allow ourselves, when we immerse ourselves in a text like this, the more deeply we can immerse ourselves in it, the better. But you know, even a little bit makes a difference. What's happening is that the wisdom of the text is rewriting the source code. The wisdom of the sutras, which is, remember, the voice of the guru, which is to say the voice of Shiva, which is to say the voice of your own inner self, is busily rewriting the source code, the conditioned understanding that has been keeping you from self-recognition. So your part is to just stay in touch with the teachings, to read them, to study them, to discuss them, and to practice, both to practice internally in meditation and to practice walking around. So this is what allows this rewriting of the source code to take place, because the text comes directly from source and it takes us back to the source. So Gururupayaha is a passage that Lakshmanju quotes in his commentary on this sutra. He says, the qualification of a master is that he causes you to realize what is first and what is last and how to combine it. Now, these words relate to a very esoteric aspect of the Shiva Sutras, which we're not going to discuss today because it's so involved in the culture of Sanskrit language mysticism. But the deeper meaning of this statement The master is one who causes you to realize what is first and what is last and how to combine it. What it ultimately means is that the guru principle shows you that what is first is Shiva. What is first is absolute awareness. That is the transcendent source, which always includes Shakti. What is last is the dense physicality of the earth and your own body. So Shiva is first because Shiva is the source. The physical universe is last because it is the final product of the manifestation that flows as Shakti out of Shiva. The point being that the Shivaness is inside the earthiness, and that A, they are already combined, but that B, through our practice, the physical density of the, you know, the embodied consciousness that we are at this moment melts back stage by stage until it reunites with the source. And we as individual beings are reunited with that, which is not only what we came from, but what we most deeply are. So combining the first and last is realizing how the manifest universe is contained within Shiva and how God is fully pervading the manifest universe. And I want to offer you five ways in which we normally experience this. One, obviously, and we've been doing that very much during this class, is to recognize that truth within your own awareness. First, when you become aware of awareness and begin to be able to take rest in it, first for a few seconds, then for a little bit longer, and eventually begin to experience that awareness is not only present as that which lets you experience your life, but also contains your life. And the more you hold this, the more you begin to recognize that the awareness that underlies your experience is also completely infused into every aspect of your experience. So another way we realize it, of course, is when we listen to the sound of the breath as Hamsa and begin to become aware of the pause at the beginning and end of the inhalation and exhalation, and to allow ourselves to linger in that pause. And then in that moment, when the gap in the center of the breath opens and you are plunged into the center, the central space between activities, between one breath and another, which is called the madhya, and you recognize that behind your breath, behind your thoughts, is this vast ocean of consciousness which can suddenly emerge and follow you up. This is what it means to have the first and the last, as it were, combine themselves. Another way this happens is when you're meditating in the central channel, the Sushumna Nadi, and again, your awareness reverses itself, flows back into itself. And another is simply those moments when you can look out into the world, move through the world, and recognize that every tree, every leaf, every piece of plastic even, is reverberating with a live awareness. So these are just some of the ways we can have that experience that the guru principle opens up for us. And these experiences, of course, accumulate until more and more they become, if not our default experience, experiences that we can enter and re-enter more or less at will. And these developments of in which we sink more and more deeply into the underlying awareness that lives behind our mind, that lives behind the breath, that also lives in every cell of the body, in every particle, every atom of the body. This ability unfolds, and it might unfold very subtly, and then sometimes very dramatically. You know, they sometimes say that big shifts happen gradually, little by little, and then all at once. And this is kind of how it is I've found with spiritual unfoldment. So part of what is happening as the Guru Shakti moves through the body is that our attitude towards our body, or we could say our bodies, begins to change. So in Sutra 8, Shariram Havihi describes both this process and also one of the very core practices that I like to use as a walking around practice, and which I think for many of you is, you know, has become a kind of a go-to way of practicing. So Sharira is the body, not just the physical body, but all the inner bodies as well. In fact, Lakshmanju, in a very, very helpful passage, which I'm going to recommend you reading if you haven't already during the course of this upcoming week, Lakshmanju says that the word sharira, which is usually translated as body, the idea that you offer your body, is not quite the way it should be translated, is that what is offered is your identification with the different bodies. Let me explain a little bit what that means. I'll do that in a minute. First of all, making offerings, as many of you know, is one of the most basic acts of religious ritual, and pretty much it's done in every tradition. In the ancient religious traditions, there was a very important ceremony in which physical objects were offered to a fire. You know, you read about it in the Bible, the burnt offerings. Sometimes, you know, in those days, and actually right up until the present day, and they still do it in certain parts of India, you actually do animal sacrifice. You offer an animal. In most modern communities, of course, we've come to understand that animal sacrifice is a form of cruelty. And what we offer, or what is generally offered in traditional ceremonies, are precious aspects of wealth, sometimes gold, sometimes jewels, grain, rice, precious woods, precious oils. They're offered into a fire that has been kindled in a ritual way, and they're offered accompanied by mantras. So the mantras both sacralize the offerings, they also are offerings themselves. The principle behind fire ceremonies is that they are a way of making a connection between the physical world, including yourself, and the higher realms, the subtler realms. And if you've ever participated in one of these ceremonies, you know that it can powerfully affect your inner state. And you also know that the fire that we make the offerings into will often give darshan. I have several pictures a friend of mine took during havan that he does regularly. He does a fire offering every Friday night in honor of the goddess. And when he does these havans, you can sometimes see in the later stages of the ceremony, the fire itself will assume the form of the goddess. I'm going to see if I can scan one of these pictures and offer it to you. It's really kind of amazing. Because the mantras, the sacred mantras that we offer to the fire, really, really do have an effect on the physical world as well as on the subtle world. So external rituals are not empty. They hold a lot of transformative power if you're in the ritual space. But of course, in the Bhagavad Gita, which I think most of you have read and some of you have studied with me or with other teachers, Krishna, in his instructions to his disciple Arjuna, reinterprets this teaching into a sadhana of mental offering, of mental worship, which obviously is considered a subtler and therefore, let's say, I don't like to use the word higher because it gives a hierarchical feeling to it, and I don't want to seem to denigrate external ritual, which are very powerful in their own way. But what Krishna is pointing out in the Gita, and what is really the wisdom contained in this sutra as well, that the one fail-safe, unbeatable method of turning your entire life into yoga is to offer everything you do to divine consciousness or to deity. You know, if you're a devotional person with a personal deity, you would offer it to the deity, in Arjuna's case, Krishna. And you offer, he describes this very poetically in the text, you offer your work, you offer your food, you offer your breaths, you offer all the activities of your senses to the divine. And what he says is that, again, forgive me for the hierarchical language, the more you're offering to the absolute consciousness, the absolute divine, represented in this tradition by Shiva, but Krishna, though he has a different name and form, actually represents the same absolute consciousness. And you hold that absolute consciousness within yourself. You are that, and you're at the deepest level. So the idea of offering is that you just offer everything you do, everything you think, everything you wear, everything you feel into the sacred consciousness. And in that way, you make all your actions sacred, so that all the activities of your senses, rather than separating you from reality, actually infuse your sense activities with total divine awareness. And in this way, your life becomes worship. It's, you know, those of you who've done this, and I know many of you have, know that it is in itself a tremendously transformative experience. Partly because when you're offering your actions, you know, there's a couple of things that happen. One is, first of all, if you're really making an offering to the divine, you generally want to make your offering as beautiful as possible. So making offerings of your actions actually encourages you to be more conscious in the way you do them. But the other thing about making offerings is that it loosens your feeling of being the doer of everything. It actually allows you to cultivate the deep wisdom behind all these teachings, which is the recognition that everything that is occurring through your body, through your mind, through your senses, is actually being orchestrated by the divine Shakti. And so you can do this practice of offering as a devotional practice, or you can do it as a wisdom practice, that is, recognizing that what you're offering to is awareness itself. The devotional part of it is where most of us start. I certainly did. And a friend of mine often talks about how he was once walking in the mountains in Nepal with his Tibetan teacher. And my friends commented on how beautiful the mountains looked. And his teacher said, you know, the difference between you and me is in what we do when we see this beauty. He said, when I see beauty, the first thing I do is offer the beauty to my teacher. Everything I see, everything I hear, everything I taste, I make it an offering. I make it an offering to my teacher. And as you can imagine, my friend was very moved and impressed by that. But you can make the offerings to your teacher, to your deity, to your consciousness, to the universe, or you can make the offerings for the peace of humanity, for the happiness of all beings. The point is to make the offering. And in my experience, and this is kind of the secret tantric understanding of how offering works, the closer to the absolute you're making, the thisness that you're making the offering to should be as untrammeled or as unconditioned a form of absolute consciousness as you can manage. Because what you offer to is eventually going to infuse you. And, you know, so that then everything that we experience in life is going to connect us to God. In Tantra, of course, the standard religious rituals are reframed as internal rituals, as meditations intended to fuel your experience of non-duality. So what the question is, what would be the non-dual offering? What would be the non-dual offering? One way is to imagine that the fire of your own awareness is the deity, and to offer to awareness everything that you identify as contributing to your sense of being a separate person. So you might start by becoming present to the presence of awareness, or to the simple sense of dynamic aliveness that you experience in meditation. Or you could do it in another way. You could station yourself in awareness. If you have that capacity, you can identify it as awareness. And consider that you are simply allowing your body and mind to serve as vehicles through which awareness and the Shakti inherent in awareness can move freely to interact with the world. So in other words, and one of the ways I like to do this, we've been doing versions of this practice all along, and I'd like to ask you to do it with me now, is to station yourself behind the heart, or if it's more comfortable for you, behind the head, so that you have the sense that you as awareness have consciously stepped outside the skin barrier. As we've said at other times, this doesn't mean you've stepped outside your body, because you're still inside your subtle body. Your subtle body is really about 3 feet wider on all sides and above and below than your physical body. So feel yourself stationed behind your physical body. Feel that you're holding your physical body inside awareness. And just breathe with that intention to be the one who is able to see the physical body that you normally identify with from all sides. Your attention is behind the body, behind the heart, perhaps. And you can begin by inhaling with the sense that you're offering the mantra hum into this awareness behind the body. And with the exhalation, have the feeling that the exhaled breath is offering sa, and that your attention can flow with the breath and the sound of sa backwards, deeper and deeper, into the field of awareness behind your body. Hum, falling in with the breath as an offering into the awareness that you've located for now, behind your body, surrounding your body. And sa, flowing with the exhalation, carrying your attention backwards so that it almost feels as though you're falling backwards into this space that is free of the physical structures of the body. And if thoughts are arising, if fears are arising, if emotions are arising, offer them with the exhalation into this sense of surrounding awareness. So the mantra and the breath are the offering. Hum, flowing with the inhalation, back into the awareness behind the body. Sa, flowing with the exhalation, as you allow the breath and your attention to carry you into the realms of awareness that extend out as far as your attention can expand. And notice, ask yourself, are there limits to this awareness? Does it have edges? Is there anywhere it stops? See if you can let yourself relax into this felt sense of expanding awareness. And its energy. And with your next inhalation, feel that you're breathing it back. You're breathing the spaciousness of this expanded awareness back inside, back into your heart. And then with the exhalation, notice that the breath can carry your awareness down into the region of the lower belly and the torso and the legs, which will tend to allow you to feel more grounded in the physical body. And you might want to just, with your hand, with your right hand, to rub your belly and your chest, rub down your legs, rub your lower back, rub your shoulders and neck, and just make tactile contact with your physical body. So we've said that, we've quoted Lakshmanju saying that what this sutra, shariram havihi, the body is the offering, actually means that what the offering is not simply the physical body, but your identification with the physical body as well as with the different layers of the self, the different koshas, the different sheaths of the soul, as they're sometimes called. So what you're offering is thoughts, emotions, images, ideas, concepts, whatever comes up that in any way grabs your attention and keeps it from expanding and from identifying with free consciousness itself. What we want to offer, in other words, is our entire tendency to identify ourselves solely with their individual body and personality. And I want to say right now that it doesn't mean that we should, you know, just let ourselves become one great big formless mess. We couldn't even if we wanted to, because our karmic conditioning is going to keep us defined by the physical body in many, many ways until we leave it, hopefully many years from now. But what those of you who've done this kind of practice of making your bodies or your identification with your individual bodies an offering is that it little by little frees you, which is pretty much what we're talking about this week. It frees you from that stuck sense of me and mine that really is the cause of suffering. Not the cause of pain, because let's face it, pain is part of embodied life, but the cause of suffering, the cause of the unnecessary discomfort that comes when we are so tightly identified with our own body and mind and personality that anything that happens that throws the body off, that seems to hurt our emotional body, that all of this feels like it's directly impacting us. Years ago when I was first beginning my practice, I was complaining to a friend about something that someone had said to me that hurt my feelings. Of course, now I don't remember what it was, because these things really stop making a difference after some time has passed, and this is a long time ago. But her response to me was to say, well, after all, there's no such person as Sally, so why get upset? Now, I have to say at the time, that was way over my head, and it actually made me a little bit impatient that she was giving me high teachings instead of sympathizing. But as time went on, I somehow never forgot that exchange. And one of the things I began to notice is that over the years, my sense that I am Sally, or I am Durgananda when I lived under a different name, began to become less and less sticky for me, because the recognition of myself as energy, myself as awareness, began more and more to be kind of my default. So when Shiva says the body is the offering, shariram havihi, he's actually referring to something that begins to happen very naturally. And again, I know that it's happening for many of you because you communicate about it. When we actually start to recognize that what we think of as what stuff that we're doing that we have under our control, such as the surge of emotions that comes up at certain moments, the impulses, the instincts, the desires, that they are actually not something that we're doing and they're not something we're responsible for. They are part of the movement of Shakti as she plays through us. They are energetic expressions that Shakti takes in order to experience her own play as the physical and mental universes, and that what you think of as you, this body-mind complex, is actually one of her most beautiful vessels for experiencing differentiation and embodiment and relationship. But it's not any entity called me that is really in the limited sense that is really experiencing it. It's me and Shakti, me and Shiva. So I'm going to explain this from another point of view, actually basing it on one of the core teachings of the Shakta Tantras, which is a teaching that the commentators on the Shiva Sutras always start to unpack at some point in the process. You know, we've spoken about this earlier, how in hardcore Shaiva Shakta practice, what the tantrikas tell us is that your experience of life in this body is actually being fully orchestrated by the Shakti chakras. These, you know, the chakra, of course, means wheel. The Shakti chakras are groups of subtle energies who work in concert with each other, which is why they're called wheels. You know, they're coordinated activities. They're all different energies that are working together in order to produce certain types of sensory experience. I think we talked about this two classes ago. Some of the Shakti chakras, their job is to give you the experience of being a particular entity who identifies herself as Sally or himself as Loring. Some of them are there to operate through the physical organs, you know, through the limbs, the organs, in order to act on this physical plane. Some of them act as the mind. Some of them act as the senses. But in the Shakta tradition, the understanding is that everything that is occurring in this world, including, you know, the sap running through the trees and, you know, the growth and decay of the dahlias on your lawn, or, you know, all the processes of life are being orchestrated by these groups of Shaktis. And there's, you know, they're often, there's a beautiful image that's given in the Shakta Tantras about how these groups of Shaktis, which are rays, they're described as rays flowing out from the central source, Shiva, and flowing back into it. And what is said about it is that these groups of energies offer back to the source the experiences that they engender through the senses, the mind, and the body of individual beings in this world. So what the tradition says is automatically happening is that these energies that flow through you and that make you feel like you and which make you feel as though there is a world outside and make you able to interact with it, with the feeling of being me interacting with this world, that ultimately all of these playful activities of life are created by the Shakti chakras as offerings to their beloved, who is Shiva, seated in the heart of consciousness, actually seated in your heart, for the delectation, for the delight of the divine beloved. So we can just take moments from time to time to hold this idea that just as the breath comes in, flows in and flows out, just as the eyes open and close, everything that arises and subsides is arising and subsiding as a play of energies flowing out from the center and then flowing back to the center. And the practice of Hamsa Mantra, the practice of flowing Hamsa Mantra into the heart, is one of the ways that we begin to kindle this awareness in ourselves. So let's practice for a few moments with the Hamsa Mantra as an offering to the heart of consciousness, personified as your own heart, as your own heart center. So find your space, find your center. And begin to hear the breath flowing as hum and sa. Hum flowing with the inhalation. Sa flowing with the exhalation. And as the breath flows in with hum, have the feeling that it is being offered into the heart, into the space behind the breastbone. And as the exhalation flows out with sa, Feel that the breath is being offered to the space outside the heart in the front of the body. Feel that the breath is actually making an offering. And as the breath and the mantra begin to bring you more and more into energetic awareness of your heart space, let your attention gently flow through the back body into the large heart, the great heart behind the body, so that syllable hum offered with the inhalation flows through the heart and into the great heart region, opening up behind the body. And then the exhalation flows as an offering into the expanding space in front of the body. These are the spaces we've been opening up through the meditation we did earlier. And as you breathe with hum and sa, let yourself kinesthetically experience the energy inside the syllables, mingling with the energy of the breath. And notice that as you allow the inhalation, as you invite the inhalation to flow through the heart into the region behind the body, that the energy inside the breath and the energy inside the mantra are in a subtle way carving a path for your awareness to recognize that you are much larger than your skin boundaries will make you believe. And as sa flows outward from the heart and merges in the space of the body, you might begin to experience the fact that at the end of each phase of the breath, at the end of the inhalation, before the exhalation begins, there is this little gap. That same little gap exists at the end of the exhalation, as you know. See if you can simply feel that the breath is flowing between these two open, spacious, expanded points. One, the great heart space behind the body. The other, the great heart space in front of the body. The breath and the mantra are making offerings to the great heart. So one reason why the Hamsa Soham Mantra is so significant in Tantra, and actually in several of the Tantric traditions, is because it's always expressing itself through the breath. So to practice it does not involve you in doing something separate from the natural process of life. So just being present to the fact that the breath is always happening on its own, it's always in the present moment, and that it's always making this little sound, even though when we go deep in meditation, the sound, we stop hearing the sound. But that said, as we practice with Hamsa, it eventually becomes clear that the sound of Hamsa is actually a self-repeating sound. By practicing it for a while, we kind of make it possible for the energy of Hamsa to reveal itself as really an ever-present phenomenon. And as the Shakti in the mantra starts to soften and open your physical body, which is what it's doing when we do this practice, you do begin to see that not just your inner body, your subtle body, but also your physical body is made of energy, and that the frame, the forms that we call our body, that we call our mind, are not really fixed. Even the physical body is not really fixed, which is not even the brain is fixed, as we know. You know, our sense of body boundaries melts whenever meditation gets deep. And that subtle, fluid recognition of ourselves begins to actually, you know, flow out into your waking life. And this is how your inner experience starts to transform your external experience, so that even though, you know, very often when we've been meditating deeply, we come, you know, the body-mind reassembles itself post-meditation, and we, you know, we forget our inner experience and re-identify with our personal self and our empirical self, which is normal and natural and what we're supposed to do living here in the physical world. Nonetheless, over time, we start to recognize that we can segue very naturally in open-eyed states between being the person that, you know, is functioning in the physical world and being the subtle energy. So with every session of practice, you're loosening that identification with the individual bodies, dissolving the stickiness, the Velcro that makes you believe that this is who you are, and the veils of your identity as a physical body and as a personality begin to become more and more attenuated, more and more soft. So there are many phases of this, many stages of this, and there are many practices for opening up to it. So I'd like to do a couple of practices that are really dedicated to helping us lift the identification with both the body and the mind. You've done some of these with me earlier. So the first one is a Shakta Upaya practice for becoming aware of awareness. Close your eyes, let the breath bring you deeply into the body. Ask yourself, if I don't use thinking, if I don't rely on memory, if I'm without emotions, if I let go of perceptions, what am I? What is left? What am I without thoughts? What am I without emotions? What am I without memories? What am I without perception? What is I? So as you ask yourself this question, as you know, when you're doing this kind of self-inquiry, you don't want to give yourself a verbal answer because that's just another thought. You want to pay attention to the subtle spaciousness that arises in the immediate wake of the question. And just let yourself, as much as possible, for as long as possible, just rest there. So, without thoughts, without memories, without emotions, without intentions, without perception, what am I? Feel into that space that arises in the wake of the question. Again, without thoughts, without emotions, without memories, without intention, without attention, what am I? At a certain point, thoughts, memories, emotions, perceptions come back into the field. So we ask the question again. If I let go of thoughts, emotions, memories, perceptions, what am I? What is I? When I was about 20, I was alone in my mother's house on a summer day. And this question came up. Aside from my opinions, aside from my ideas, what's real about me? What am I really? And I was, of course, trying to find the answer. I was trying to find a way of defining my personal self that was more permanent, more lasting than the play of ideas and opinions that I often identified with, and I couldn't come up with an answer. But what I realized later is that that impulse to find out, you know, aside from my opinions, aside from my thoughts, what am I? What am I really? This is Shiva's question. This is the question that we can ask ourselves without an agenda. I mean, I think we all know that there's a so-called right answer to this question. Maybe we could say the, quote, right answer is I am the self. But let that go and just let's just ask the question again. Without thought, without emotion, without memory, without perceptions, without intentions, what am I? That which rises in answer to that question. Is consciousness, awareness. Without thoughts, without emotions, without ideas, without memories, without perceptions, what am I really? Now, some of you may have had an expansive experience during that contemplation. Some of you, not so much. Some of you may have kind of been fielding different thoughts about it. I'd like to ask you to play with this practice during the week to come. But what will tend to happen as you practice with this is that you begin to become more and more familiar with the energy that is present behind your thoughts, feelings, ideas, emotions, perceptions. And the more you begin to actually feel confident that you can take rest in it, even though there are no forms in it and there seems to be no ground in it. And this is what it means to say shariram havihi. It's what it means to make your body the offering. Again, not so much your physical body, though that's part of it, as your identification with yourself as a particular form. So, in time, what happens is that the pure I consciousness itself, which is present at an even deeper level than what we experience when we do that very short version of this inquiry practice, that pure I begins to rise up, kind of take over, swallow up your sense of your physical body and all the forms you're aware of, so that the world and your identified body literally disappears into consciousness. It just dissolves for a few minutes. It melts. It's a process that in the tantras is called laya, L-A-Y-A, which literally means dissolution or melting. And it's the process in which the different layers that you identify as yourself begin to retire, each one of them into a slightly subtler layer. And the more lovingly you can approach this process, the more comfortable you become in your own freedom. Sutra 9, which follows Shariram Havihi, says, Jnanam Annam, or knowledge is food. And this sutra has two different meanings. One of them is what we've been discussing through the class, which is this understanding that as you meditate on awareness, whether through the mantra, through immersing yourself in the mantra and letting the mantra become an offering into your expanded heart, or letting the mantra draw your attention to the gap, the space between the inhalation and exhalation, the space where the sound of the mantra comes to an end and from which it arises. As you pay more attention to that space, especially as the mantra becomes so deeply embedded into your energy body, the mantra itself, the space of the heart, the awareness that becomes present when you ask, when you do a self-inquiry like the one we just did, literally eats up your conditioned ideas. It devours your thoughts and feelings. The Shakti in the mantra and the Shakti in awareness reduces your embedded ideas about yourself into energetic particles and swallows them. And I want you to know this is not a metaphor. It is something that actually happens that many of you have experienced. Or if you don't experience it while it's in process, you notice at the end of a meditation session or at the end of a mantra session that there's been a shift, that something much more alive and free and vibrant has emerged. And it, you know, what it means is that the energy within the mantra or the energy within your meditative state has devoured another layer of the backpack of ideas and concepts and sensations that make you feel separate and that create suffering. And, you know, when you've been doing these practices for a while, and again, for many of you, this is very familiar, you just notice that there's not so much disturbance in your energy body. You're clearer. You may feel better about yourself. The overwhelming recurrence of negative self-talk, if you're the kind of person who has a lot of negative self-talk, has died down. Your mind is just generally quieter. Your heart is more open. Your love is more available. And even during difficult times, even when you feel really, really upset, there is this connection to your own awareness that is accessible, that you can find, that you can take rest in and refuge in. And in this sense, and this is the sort of deepest, most non-dual interpretation of this sutra, formless awareness has used as fuel your own thoughts and limiting ideas. And just think about that for a minute. When the Shakti in awareness, or the Shakti in mantra, does this process of clearing out your mind and clearing out your inner body, which I know that all of you have experienced at some point, either in meditation or over time, what you have to understand is that there is literally a process in which your limited knowledge, because that's what the Shiva Sutras means when they use this term jnanam, they mean limited knowledge, not absolute knowledge. It's just one of the quirks of the vocabulary of the sutra. Every time you sit for meditation and touch the self, even for a couple of seconds, even though you feel that your mind has been really busy all through the meditation, what is actually happening is that the underlying consciousness behind thought, embedded in the mantra, has devoured the impurities of your limited conditioning a little bit more. And these ideas actually can become a fuel that strengthens your consciousness, that strengthens your ability to remain steady in the experience of consciousness. Your part in this process is to keep remembering that the ideas are just ideas. Even the beautiful high ideas are just ideas. Even the ideas that can be helpful, such as these teachings, have to also be offered back into the fire of consciousness, into the energy of the mantra. And what the energy of your consciousness will do for you over time is eliminate the ideas that contract you and use the expansive ideas to fuel your liberation. It's really quite a remarkable process. Consciousness knows what food nourishes it and what food is poison. And it will eventually dissolve the poisonous food. And by poisonous food, I mean those thoughts like, I'm just Sally, or I'm not good enough, or I'm the smartest person in the room, or I have to have this in order to be happy. All those thoughts, which are poison for your liberated self, they all get dissolved, devoured. You don't have to beat yourself up for having them. You just have to keep offering them into the fire of consciousness, into the fire of the mantra, into the lap of the deity, if you love to meditate on deity, and have faith that in time they get dissolved. So as we bring this session to a close, I want to wish that you continue to invite this process to deepen through practicing. Through practicing with the recognition of the wisdom underlying all these sutras, which is essentially the recognition that your awareness is God. If you don't like that word, you can say source, or you can say creative power of the universe. But the point is, your awareness, limited as it may be at this moment, is in its essence the same awareness out of which everything arises and into which everything dissolves. So this is the knowledge embedded in the Shiva Sutras. And this is the knowledge that feeds you. Yonyanam Anam has two meanings, like so many of these sutras. On the one hand, it means that the limiting knowledge is devoured by awareness. On the other hand, it means that the wisdom, the knowledge that is wisdom, feeds awareness so that it becomes more and more your default setting, your default mode network. And then these ideas come up to explain an experience which you may not have understood. They arise as insights. They help you stay steady in resting in awareness. And they give you confidence that who you are is not limited by what you learned from your family, what the people at work say to you when they're in a bad mood, by the pain of fulfilling certain responsibilities, by the fear that comes up around challenge and the grief that comes up around loss, that you're not defined by any of this, that you are that awareness which is present to all of it and holding it all. You know, in one of Abhinavagupta's great statements in his book, Tantra Loka, he says, liberation is not like attaining some great prize or some new state. Liberation is putting down a burden that you have been carrying for such a long time. And that burden is the burden of your limiting ideas. It's just a matter of time. As you allow this wisdom and these practices to empower your awareness, it really is just a matter of time before you are taking rest in what you are. Not just occasionally, not just in meditation, but pretty much all day long. My guru once wrote, and I believe I've quoted this to you before, no one knows how the enlightened masters attain their state. They just follow this exalted path, and like the sun rising in the east, the experience of liberation arises on its own. So may this be so for all of us, sooner rather than later. You'll be getting a homework assignment on these sutras tomorrow. Please tell us on the listserv what you're experiencing, what questions you have. The listserv will be up for at least another 2 weeks and maybe more, so we can all continue to speak to each other through that medium. I want to thank you again and again for everything that you contribute, both energetically and through your words, to this process. We'll once again enter the Shiva Sutras in our next class in November, and I want to encourage you to read through the homework assignments, to listen again to those calls which you feel drawn to, and to do the practices. Not only the one or two practices that feel like part of your daily meditation. I hate to use the word routine, but your normal meditation practice. But also the ones that you may not have had time to practice during this 6-week period, but which you might like to experiment with over the next few months. So have a beautiful evening and a beautiful week to come. And we'll just sit for another few minutes, allowing Hamsa to flow with the breath into the great heart. Hum flowing in with the inhalation, Sa flowing with the exhalation. Your awareness poised in the region of the great heart, behind the body, and the region of the great heart in front of the body. The breath flowing easily and evenly. Hum with the inhalation, Sa with the exhalation, telling you again and again, I am that. I am Shiva Shakti. I am pure awareness. Whatever else is true, this is the deepest truth. And in that tiny space at the end of the inhalation, where the breath merges into the heart and the mantra merges into silence, find the space of the madhya. Don't try to cling to it. Just know that it's there, and that even if you touch it for a fraction of a second, it's inviting you. Allow the mantra to become the sound of the breath, and allow the space in the midst of inhaling and exhaling to become an open door that invites you into the pure presence that is the source, not only of your life, but of all that is. With much love, good night.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमिन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातुर्न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न
न मे द्वेष रागौ न मे लोभ मोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्य भाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानंद रूपं शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपं शिवोहं शिवोहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखं न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकार रूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासंगतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानं शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपं शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं 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 शिवोहं।